So what are we about to see?
We are about to see the new Frederick Wiseman film.
Frederick Wiseman?
Frederick Wiseman.
Oh. Mm. How long is it?
4 hours.
Yeah. We drove all the way to Seattle. Mm-hmm. We're on the Sif Egyptian, one of my favorite theaters. We're going to see the new Frederick Wiseman film.
Yeah.
Dude's about to turn 93. Has a new movie in theaters.
Ooh.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. So excited.
4 hours in a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. A couple things to note just about the podcast in general.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start, I think I might want to start trying out what it's like to release on Wednesdays.
Mm-hmm.
This podcast is going to be released on Wednesday.
And it's your weekend.
Well, yeah, because yes. So my work schedule changed, and so it has been less and less convenient to put stuff out on Mondays.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I'm working Mondays, have been working Mondays. But also, I'm about to be a housewife, or as some people might say, unemployed for the foreseeable future. So the days don't really matter. And also, we're talking Wiseman. So Wiseman Wednesdays, let's bring it back, baby. Wiseman Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just wanted to note a couple things on our discussion of Menu Plus Years.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I've watch 1 4-minute interview with Wiseman that's kind of cleared up some stuff that we talked about with Menu Plus Years. One, I talk about how it seems like there's more cameras at work at play.
Oh, no, yeah. You told me about that.
Yeah. Because there's so many close-ups and so much coverage.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to get so much coverage in this movie because it's a routine. And so as he was shooting over 7 weeks, he could shoot the exact same thing from different angles. Because of the creation of the dishes is just the same every day.
And so it seems like we're looking at one day, but we're not.
Yeah, we're looking at several days, and he's just cutting between the close-ups and the semi-close-ups and the wides.
We're looking at the average day.
Yeah, anyway, so it's beautiful. So it's brilliant work of editing then.
Yeah.
I would not have known. It's still his single camera deal. It's just, since they're doing the same thing every day. Anyway, so that's helpful to know. And then also, I talked about how I didn't like how there was no dishwasher.
Mm.
The 1 little 4-minute interview for a film at Lincoln Center, which someday I want to go there to that theater because they have the best. They're always showing the coolest things.
Mm.
Their website I frequented during the pandemic when there was a lot of online, when you could, like, theaters were doing virtual cinemas.
Mm.
And so I frequented Film at Lincoln Center. Because they had a lot of cool movies in theaters. Anyway, this 1 little 4-minute, and he talked specifically about his focus on the film was the journey of the food and its preparation and presentation.
Yep.
And so I guess it makes sense then why we don't really see much in terms of the other kitchen work that doesn't have to do with the food.
Because it has been eaten. The food is no longer present.
The food is no longer present, so it's irrelevant. Now, if this was a movie about a restaurant, then I would be, I would say that it is lacking.
Then we wouldn't see the cheese and stuff.
Yeah. But specifically, this is about the journey of the food, its journey to the table, to the customer, and how it is presented to the people. This makes more sense now. That makes sense. Yes.
No, I remember you showing me the video.
Yeah. No, we watched it last night. Anyway. Also, I said that this is upper-tier Wiseman for me.
Mm.
But then I forgot how much I like Wiseman movies. And so it's actually, just by looking at it, it looks like middle-of-the-road Wiseman. Mm. But that's just because I love so many Wiseman movies.
Mm.
As much as I like this one, and so it just happens to be at the bottom of the best of Wiseman.
Mm.
Anyway, just because, man, I love those domestic violence movies. Good morning. Welcome back to Excerpts from the ABBA Archives, a podcast that's not about ABBA, it's about us. My name is B. Peterson. With me, as always, is...
A Kirby.
Welcome to the stub episode. This is the stub episode because we recorded an entire episode.
Like 3 hours or something.
Like 3 hours of audio. And we talked about a lot of great movies and had a lot of great discussion. And those discussions happened to be held in a moving vehicle. I thought it was a great idea to record to and from Seattle in our drive. And that audio was all garbage. It's very bad audio. So we're going to record the whole episode again, but this time it'll be very quick.
Yeah.
And less good. All right. We started off, we watched some comedies, we watched some biopics, we watched some movies from Japan, and then we watched the new Frederick Wiseman movie.
Yeah.
So let's start off with the comedies, Young Frankenstein. Tell me about Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, so a movie from when I was a kid that my parents really like, and so we watched a bunch. Yeah, I'm quite fond of it. I love the way it adapts the first three Frankenstein films, particularly Son of Frankenstein, which you haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it references all of them really well. It really likes to live in that world, which is really cool to see. Yeah, I think it has some stuff that didn't work so well this go around.
Yeah.
I noticed a lot more.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor in Young Frankenstein at the expense of disabled folks. lots of making fun of people with prosthetic arms, or people who are blind, or mute, or who have a hunchback. Just like Igor, the guy who plays Igor, his name is...
Marty Feldman.
Marty Feldman plays it very well. He's the best thing in the movie. There's a lot of humor that just hasn't aged. And that's not to speak of the worst part of the movie, which is... Now, I had seen this movie before, but it was before I had taste, as I like to say. Anyway, and notably, it's before I had seen any of the actual Frankenstein movies. So it was just kind of, just watching this, it was kind of blah to me just in general. This time around, I was like, so this is going to be the Frankenstein movies but funny, but no, it's the Frankenstein movies but horny. This is a sex farce, I think, first and foremost. And there's a lot of stuff in there in this movie that works. About the sex farce. But there's also the scene with Madeline Kahn in the cave, that is just a sexual assault scene.
Yeah.
And that plays that for a joke. And there was a way to play that scene, like where she could have been into it, you know, that would have made it work.
Yeah. And would have ended, like, still got the movie to the end that it wanted to have.
Yeah, because it ends with the monster and Madeline Kahn as the bride. You know, it ends with them, you know, having a blast together. And yeah, that works, and it's really funny. But the relationship started terribly. And you could have had her as like, oh, you've kidnapped me, and now, well, oh my, you're a big guy, aren't you? Oh, let me see what you got. Like, there could have been a way to play it that would have been in line with all the characters and wouldn't have needed to involve a sexual assault.
Yeah.
Anyway. Also, I find Gene Wilder's performance in this grating, and I don't like it that much. I think he just spends a lot of the movie shouting, which I don't find funny. I think this is a trend for me. Between this and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, movies that you find funny. And I'm like, they're yelling a lot and I don't like it.
Which I think is just a matter of taste, and that's something that bothers you, but not me.
Yeah. No, there are jokes that he does great that he delivers quietly. But anyway. So that's Young Frankenstein. Then we have moving from a satire parody film to Shakespeare, we have Much Ado About Nothing, which is delightful.
you know, my mom is an English teacher and teaches Shakespeare, and so this is one that, an adaptation that she likes and has, you know, shown me for a while. Yeah, and I really like it. It's a very, a very pleasant watch for me.
Yeah. Comfort watch, maybe?
Very, very that, yeah. It's Shakespeare, which is kind of a comfort watch for me, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, but then it's very, like, just sun and countryside and pretty scenery. It's always sunny and warm and, kind of perfect in that way. And then there's the romance that I really like between Beatrice and Benedict that mm-hmm. I just, it's the, enemies to lovers that works for me a little bit. They yeah. have this like rivalry that, and then they get tricked into falling for each other.
Yes.
Which it just works really well. They're very cute.
Yeah. It's clearly what Kenneth Branagh, he clearly cast himself as Benedict because he did the meatiest role and he wanted the best scene in the movie, mm-hmm. which is when the cast in this movie,
mm-hmm.
Emma Thompson, hello.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth Branagh, nameless man who looks like, who is Claudio, Keanu Reeves, Denzel Washington, like, just, and at the beginning of the movie, it's the most bisexual opening to a movie ever, where everyone's like, hello, we're all here at this Italian villa, let us strip naked and bathe together and rub up and, yes, we're all here to get horny and screw and make love and wed. And, very, appealing opening to the movie.
And, like, they haven't seen each other in a while because there's some battle that, like, all these yeah. men are coming back from and, like, visiting friends.
Yeah.
And so there's, like, yes, we get to see all these people and have sex with them.
Yes. Anyway, the best scene in the movie is Kenneth Branagh is hiding behind some hedges, absolutely, practically chewing them. Because he's chewing the scenery so much. Literally, he's chewing the hedges, and he's chewing his chair, which is a beautiful busy work with the chair. It's great. Anyway, and then Polonius, because it's Polonius from Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet, Polonius and Claudio and Don Pedro Denzel Washington are scheming to set him up with Beatrice. And so they're pretending to... They're talking about how much she loves him and thinking that... He's not there, but of course he is there and listening, and they know that. Anyway, and it's so over the top, but it's Shakespeare over the top, where they're playing to the back of the theater, and mm-hmm. it works. It really does translate, because of the language, because of, you know. Anyway, that's the best bit in the movie for me, in terms of comedically.
By
best,
far,
You mentioned the best bit in the movie emotionally is Beatrice and Benedict again, but this time in the church.
Mm.
The plot of this movie. So there's the first half of this movie, and then there's the second half of this movie. And the first half of this movie is really fun and delightful. And it's about getting people together. And then the second half of this movie is the much ado about nothing part.
Mm.
And it's where Keanu Reeves, who's just a mope and a sad sack. He concocts this plan to break up this couple because why not? He's angsty little sad Keanu.
And my brother likes one of the people in this couple and I don't like my brother, so...
Yeah. Anyway, so he concocts this plan to make Claudio think that Hero, his betrothed, is unfaithful. And I called the scene right before it happened. I was like, honey, is he about to shame Hero at the wedding in front of everyone? And you're like, yes, that is exactly what's about to happen. I'm like, I don't want to watch it. So we took a break. We eventually came back and then it happened. And then the rest of the movie is trying to undo it. Thanks to Michael Keaton in an absolute bizarre turn as Dogberry. I was so unprepared for that.
I love your actress, Michael Keaton.
And he's going full Beetlejuice. Like, this is 2 years after Beetlejuice. He's, yeah. Like,
and just his little faces.
Yeah. The man is at an 11. No one else is. And they're all clearly a little annoyed by his presence. And I don't know if that's because Dogberry is annoying or just because, Michael Keaton, you're overacting. Tone it down a little. Though I guess it's fine because we have Keanu who's like underplaying it, and then we have Michael Keaton who's overplaying it. So I guess they cancel each other out.
Anyway.
Yeah, so Claudio sucks. Just deeply.
He doesn't redeem himself in any meaningful way.
No.
I think he's horrible to this person. He never like talks to her and it's like, "Hey,
I saw this last night. I saw this last night. He was calling your name. Was that you?" She'd be like, "No, my friend was in there that night."
Yeah.
And then, or they could have a talk, and maybe he wouldn't believe her, and they said, "Hey, I think the wedding's off," and that'll be that, and that's fine too. But instead, he waits for the wedding to call it out and publicly paint her as insert slur for unfaithful.
Yeah, and like, which also could work for me if then she didn't want him at the end and like he got punished for being like that to her.
This movie would work because they concoct a scheme where she's apparently died of grief
to make him feel bad.
To make him feel
like,
bad.
Look what you did.
And but then to surprise him with once he's with her, you know. Mm. So he's like, "Congratulations, she's actually alive. You can be together."
After he's written a, what is it, an epitaph? Or
yeah, once he's like formally proclaimed, you know, his apologies.
Yeah.
I don't buy it. If they had gotten him to do all that, and she'd be like, "And screw you, I'm not marrying you. You suck." Yeah. Then it would be fine.
And there's one, I'm thinking, there's one production, I think it might be Two Gentlemen of Verona that I saw,
mm-hmm.
where I think, I forget, I've only seen it once, and I forget exactly how the play works.
Verona, as in Romeo and Juliet?
No, a different play.
Also set in Verona.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this one set in Verona?
I don't think so.
Anyway, it's set in Italy in the movie, anyway.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I think in that, staged adaptation, I want to say, like, they have another relationship like that where it's like, yeah, she really shouldn't be with him in the end. Mm-hmm. And so what they have is they keep all the lines, but they use cues to suggest to kind of, and maybe the play, the language allows this easier, that they can kind of twist a little so she walks away from him in the end. Mm. Even though they keep the language, they just stage it different.
Yeah, I've thought about doing that for like certain ends of, like the end of Twelfth Night. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh no, I'm gonna go throw off this, you know, mm-hmm. these clothes and put on my real clothes, like mm-hmm. to make that thing. But then also with this movie, what we could do is we could just have Hero take the speech towards Malvolio in Twelfth Night and just give it to mm-hmm. Hero in this, just be like, "You suck. No one likes you."
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, I think that the film has like problems inherent to the text that yeah. the film doesn't totally deal with. The saving grace of this movie is its focus on Benedict and Beatrice.
Yeah.
And they're delightful.
Because we're here for them.
We're here for them. The movie's clearly here for them.
Yeah. And it does have one that scene in the little church that mm-hmm. That really stood out to me this watch. And it's Emma Thompson is great, throwing, like, getting mad about her cousin being treated this way.
Yeah,
after you know,
yeah.
what happens at the wedding. And so, and Benedict confesses his love, and then they're like, oh.
They're loving, but also, you need to stand up for my girl.
Yeah, she says, she's been falsely accused, and you can't let her be treated like that, and I can't do anything, because
mm-hmm.
I'm not a man, or whatever, but you can do something.
And he's like, "No, my bro."
Yeah.
And she's like, "No, host before bro."
And I really like it in the sense of like, you need, if you love the woman in your life, you have to love the woman in your life. You can't love them and then ditch them for the men. Like
yeah.
you have to support them if you actually care about them. And I really liked that aspect. And yeah. that he actually does
He does.
Support her.
Yeah, he does. He goes along with the scheme, but also just he's like, yes, I will duel, you know, Claudio if that's what it takes.
I recognize that this is wrong, and I can do something about that.
Yeah, even though it's my boy.
And the guy, like, almost, like, laughs it off at first, because he's like,
what?
Oh, wait, you're serious. You're not, you're not down with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I like that aspect.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, yeah, Beatrice is just a really well-written character.
Yeah, and...
One of the better Shakespeare's women, probably, ever.
Yeah. And Emma Thompson brings it.
Oh, yeah, she's fantastic.
Dang.
Yeah. All right, so from satire, parody, to Shakespeare, to silent slapstick.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
We watched The General. Mm-hmm. We finally watched The General. One of the greatest movies of all time, they've all told us. Mm-hmm. It's Buster Keaton's The General. Building up to Buster Keaton's The General.
Yeah.
Forever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And we've seen a fair amount of Keaton. Mm-hmm. We've seen several of his shorts. We've seen Sherlock Jr. So here we go, The General. Mad Max Fury Road, 90 years before Mad Max Fury Road. Mm. And it's about trains.
Yeah.
And train chases. Mm. And Buster Keaton and visual gags and stunt work that is going to blow your mind.
Ooh. Yeah.
It's all of those things.
It, for much of the movie, is a pretty great watch. Yeah, I love me a good train chase, and love me some Buster Keaton stunts.
Just having a rough day.
And it's
the roughest of days.
It's Buster Keaton's, like, kind of straight face, just looking sad as he's just having a hard time.
Yeah, he's like, nothing is going right for me ever, and yet he manages to get out of it. You know, it's a great character, Buster Keaton's stone-faced sad sack.
Yeah.
He's just a sad little boy. So yeah, so that's all there. But unfortunately, the movie is about the South.
Yeah.
And it's about the South. And like the triumphant ending of this movie isn't a train chase. It's a huge battle sequence where Buster Keaton leads the South to humiliate the North and is happily promoted to lieutenant. And that's the happy ending of the movie, and it's just, why did you choose this? They talk about how this is one of the best movies ever made, and I don't see how one can morally say that.
Yes.
Like, if you took off, if you made the exact, if this movie was the exact same movie, but it was set in, like, between Austria and Germany or whatever, and instead of the Union, it was the Allies, and instead of the South, it was the Nazis, and this was made in the early 40s in Germany, and it was the exact same movie with the exact same gags and the exact same everything. It was just different flags and outfits. Is this one of the best movies ever made?
Oh.
I don't think so.
How lenient can we be towards the South?
Yeah, no, I'm not, like, this movie does not interrogate the South at all. It doesn't interrogate the war at all, and I'm not saying that there are shots in this movie, you know, where crowd shots or whatever, people getting off the train, and there are, you know, enslaved people carrying the bags for their masters, quote-unquote, and it's the people who owned the deeds to them, you know, like, and it's... The film doesn't interrogate that. The film is happily set in the South and, like, and it doesn't interrogate the evil of it.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, so it was endlessly distracting.
Yep.
Watching the movie. And because of that, I don't think I can call it one of the greatest movies ever made. There are very good bits. He does a wonderful job as a stuntman. Mm-hmm. It's a very good direction. It's a very bad script.
Yeah.
Because you could have written this very easily you could have written this without all of these issues.
But you did.
But you didn't.
And
at some point you chose, let's do a heroic portrait of the Confederate Army.
Yeah, and it's like, and because so much of it is gags and so much of it is simple get the girl, get back plot, there are so, like, infinitely many situations that are not supporting the Confederacy that would allow you to do the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's just, it's disappointing, I think, ultimately.
Yeah.
Like, it's a good... It's a successful motion picture structurally, and again, like, it's funny, and you go, wow, a lot.
It's a very enjoyable watch if you can ignore.
But I don't want politics. To.
Yeah.
I don't want to ignore that.
Yeah.
I don't think I should ignore that. I think it's wrong to ignore that. So, yeah. Speaking of which, Labyrinth of Cinema. Mm. We watched three films from Japan. The first of which was Labyrinth of Cinema, which is, I think, one of the better films that I've seen in the last few to come out in the last few years. Nobuhiko Obayashi, who did House,
which I love.
which we saw together. I don't know, remember when we saw it together, but I got it to you for you for Christmas last year.
So we saw it last winter, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, great picture, and it, as much as it is a bananas wild, one can only use bananas as a descriptor for this film.
Yes.
But bananas wild, bizarre watch and full of crazy imagery and strange editing, and it's hilarious. It is also a deeply, deeply sad film. And so let's take that and its very confined scale, this haunted house picture, and make it an epic... Well, it's still technically a haunted house picture because it's a theater now. And we're going to comment on the entire history of Japanese military imperialism through the lens of cinema. It's going to be hilarious and very sad and huge and intimate. And it's going to be all the things... And it's going to use incredibly amateur special effects, and yet still capture you with its majesty. Like it's wild what this movie does. It opens in like a spaceship filled with goldfish, and there's text on screen for the entire 3-hour runtime that is paced like a freight train. Anyway, and yet it still emerges despite its surface level, what the frick is this? This is goofy looking and edited very strangely. A very searing anti-war statement.
Yeah, and there's just so much like historical reference and cinematic reference. I need like the annotated version.
It is annotated. You just can't read it.
Yeah. I need to know a lot more about Japanese history and Japanese cinema to like get all of what it's referencing and like the events it's talking about.
It's
especially the history. I think I need to give it a rewatch, knowing some more stuff because it's just so much.
Yeah, it's telling you the history of Japanese war and the history of Japanese cinema at the same time. Like we see the transition from silent to talkie, along with the transition from the transition into modern warfare with guns.
Which like is such a great
concept of like. Yeah. The samurai are getting killed off by people with guns, and what is happening? They suddenly start talking, and they're like, what? I can hear my voice! And it's funny, and yet it's also mixed in with this, you know, these very emotional seeds.
Yeah.
About how the language of violence is changing. And Yeah. It's kind of impossible to describe this movie because it's just so much. So go watch it.
Yeah.
It's on Canopy. This is annoying.
Mm.
Having to record all of this over again.
Yeah.
Like, we did this already. We talked about the movies after we saw the movies, and then we talked about the movies for 3 hours in the car.
Mm.
Now we're doing it all over again.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's a good movie, though.
It's a good movie. Yeah.
All right. Then we saw Throne of Blood.
Mm-hmm.
And Throne of Blood. Oh. Another film about how awful war is. Mm-hmm. Kira Kurosawa, Macbeth, fixes Macbeth.
Which was fine.
Yeah.
Which
it's,
was pretty great.
Yeah, like Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women, which fixed a text that wasn't broken. This movie fixes Macbeth. Toshirô Mifune as... I'm just going to call them Macbeth. I'm just going to call them their characters' names. It's... They change little things in ways that are perfect, that make the film so much stronger and the text so much stronger. I love the way the violence is portrayed in this movie in that it is not literally portrayed in this movie. The battles, the violence happens off screen. And there's a moment like when Banquo is killed. Eventually we see a head. Well, we don't see a head. We see it wrapped in a cloth. But we learn that Banquo has died because throughout this film, we are hanging out with the people who work, like the grunts, the soldiers who work at the fortresses and garrisons and castles. And we just see them like talking and eating. And then they're like, huh, why is Banquo's horse back? And it's so simple. And you're like, oh,
mm-hmm.
I love the way that violence is portrayed. Or not portrayed in this movie. But yeah, it starts out a very straightforward adaptation. You know, it's doing the thing. And then the murder of Duncan is off screen. And we stay with Lady Macbeth during that moment. And it's very powerful to then see Mifune come back and being completely distraught, in shock, can't do anything.
Yeah.
The performances throughout this film by Mifune and the woman who plays Lady Macbeth are fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
They are very archetypal performances. They are not naturalistic at all. Like in Seven Samurai, Mifune is scrappy and he's just a guy and he's a grunt and da da da. Here he is. It is theatrical. This is, I mean, we read in the essay about how it takes from no drama, and this is your mom would know more about this. But in the same way that Ron utilizes the theater as. This is, everything is very arch and stagey deliberately, that you could put masks on Mifune's face and you would still know exactly what he's thinking and feeling because of how he's using his body and his voice.
Yeah, and I definitely was noticing that this go round, that like...
You've seen it before.
Yes, once before, that he seemed like a silent film actor, that he had that level of physicality of like... of someone being used to getting stuff across without sound.
Yeah.
Just the way he held his face was like just so expressive, and the way he just took up space with, you know, his like billowing clothes and his, you know, wide stance.
Yeah. So we get to, so Macbeth is now king. Hmm. He is Lord of Spider's Web Castle. Great Lord. And the movie does a little thing that's just a little change, and it makes I always found that the Macbeth's paranoia came on a little fast, too much too quickly. And it made the film about just like a bad guy, you know, about a guy who couldn't keep his grip on reality. And in this film, because the prophecy is that he's going to be king and that his best buddy Banquo, Miki, his son will be king. So Macbeth will not have a successor. So he's now king, and what does he do? He wants to announce that Banquo's son is going to be king. It's such a simple thing. He's like, yep, that's what the prophecy said, so it'll be great.
And that's secure. You know, the prophecy said it. It's been right so far. I like my friend, so we're all cool.
Yeah, and it makes his character so much more... It makes his character make so much more sense. Because then why would you go on to... This honorable man, he kills his king because Lady Macbeth uses paranoia and tempts him and pushes him and pushes him and pushes him till he does it, and he hates it. And he hates it. He hates that he killed Duncan, but is like, all right, now I'm good, I'm secure, and I don't need to do it again. And then Lady Macbeth comes in again. And so I'm like, how is he going to get over that hump again? Is he just going to get pressured and nagged by Lady Macbeth? But no, this version, because he doesn't have an heir, so it's fine. It goes to Banquo's son. And in this version, Macbeth is like, I'm pregnant. And now it makes sense as to why Macbeth would kill Banquo and Banquo's son. Mm-hmm. Now there is a solid motivation for that violence to continue and to grow and to build. Now, it does result in Lady Macbeth becoming less of a character and more of a thematic driving of this lust for power and this lust for violence. She's very good, but her character isn't as rich to me.
Yeah. And I think just, you know, to some extent, I don't know, like, that can be said of the original play, but I think.
Well, in the original.
It takes out some of her stuff that made her character interesting.
Yeah. Like there's essentially the Lady Macbeth's only function in Throne of Blood is to prop up her husband. Mm. That is all she does. That is all she talks about. There is no, until her last moment in the film, which is the out damn spot bit, there is nothing that isn't all about her husband.
Yeah. And I think in the play she has a lot more moments of not being able to sleep and a lot more moments where we see her like suffering from guilt or having some issues with what they did, and I think we just have the one in this movie.
Yeah, which is the classic out damn spot bit.
Yeah.
I think
one thing,
and I think placing it at the very end instead of like in the middle, I think then because she's essentially she is a character of lust for violence scratched out and put in Lady Macbeth is essentially what's happened here, is that is the end, is I can't get this blood off my hands, what do I do? Putting that at the end instead of in the middle.
In terms of, like, motivation and like, making that clear, there was another piece that I liked that happens, I think, earlier on in the film, which is that when before he first kills Duncan, she provides a clear reason why he would want to, why he not only should want to, but should be afraid of not doing that, which is that...
Banquo also knows of this prophecy, and if he tells the king, then the king is going to not trust Washizu or Macbeth, and will kill him first.
Yeah, and so he... Not only is this an opportunity for him, but because he has this opportunity, he's now a threat which puts him in danger, and that he needs to
act now.
Act now, because it is now explicitly him versus the Great Lord.
Yeah.
And I really like that, because I think, like, what I remember of the play that for that specific argument, or for a lot of the argument that she brings up, is like jabs at his masculinity kind of thing, which mm-hmm. she doesn't do here. But having that rational, I don't know.
The rationalization of violence.
Yeah. I think that, like, I see it more clearly than I do in the original play, which is nice.
Yeah. So yeah, it streamlines Macbeth.
Yeah.
Essentially is what it does. And then the film slows down in its second half as you're waiting for the big battle at the end to happen. Except it turns out that the battle at the end doesn't happen, because Macbeth's undoing is freaking amazing. Instead of having this, you know, this whole battle and everything, and everything's going down, and then there's like, I had a C-section. I was born by C-section, so that's what allows me to kill you. Weird
C-section.
Weird, like, Eowyn level of loophole.
Yeah.
Instead, his downfall is so much simpler and much more effective than that, because he goes out, he gets the prophecy that, like, you're not going to lose this battle. The only way you'll lose this battle is if the trees themselves rise up against you. And
he's like, wow, that the spirit is just being really expressive in how he says, I will win.
Yeah, Macduff. but then the spirit explicitly says, like, Macduff and the Banquo's son and the prince, the great lord's son, none of them are going to defeat you. And so I'm like, I'm waiting for the C-section prophecy bit, and that doesn't happen. I'm just like, okay, all right. And then we're waiting a while for this battle, and, like, Macbeth's giving speeches, and I'm just like, can we just get to the battle? Like, I really like the first half of this movie, it really streamlined, but in the second half, it seems to be just, we're just waiting forever for this battle, and there's gonna have to be the whole battle, and then, but except it doesn't happen like that, because that speech is important, because his speech is, he's talking about the prophecy.
Hmm. Yeah, and he's telling all his people, you know, I had this prophecy that I would be the great lord, and now I'm the great lord. So, like, I, you know, these prophecies are, that I've had are, like,
they're
I,
legit. I've heard
are totally legit, totally valid, 100% certified good prophecy. And I just had this new prophecy that we won't lose unless the trees rise against us. And they're like, well, that sounds pretty great.
This is a great motivational speech.
Yeah, he pretty much just told us we're going to win this battle, so let's go win this battle. And it's a great motivator. Until,
obviously, the trees rise against us. But, and we know as the audience that, like, the soldiers are moving the trees, you know? But all we get for now, and all Macbeth and all the crowds get, are just... Because this movie's use of black and white is beautiful. It is very heavy on the white, very heavy on fog and mist. Mm. And we just see these trees just kind of, like, moving, like, swaying in the fog. And it's a very creepy shot.
And you're like, oh, they're swaying. Oh, they're swaying closer.
And so Macbeth is like, oh, frick! And Mufune's face gets so big, and his mouth is, like, so agape for so long. And he's like, and then it gets to the best moment, which is that the battle doesn't even happen because his own men turn on him. And it makes so much sense. And it's so much cleaner.
And it continues this theme of like, does the prophecy make it happen because we've heard it and now we expect it to happen?
Yeah.
Or was it already going to happen? Like that theme that's present in the original play with, you know, if he'd never heard it, would he have killed Duncan kind of questions. And I love how it continues that by saying all of his army's action is based on this prophecy.
Yeah. Like, the army ultimately betrays Macbeth because they heard this speech about the trees rising up and against them. And so then they see the trees rising up. It's like, oh, so we're going to lose the battle. So we might as well kill you. And live. And Macbeth has, and there's this great bit where Macbeth has, says, it's like, what, you would betray your great lord? And they're like, yeah, like you did? Yes, we would.
He's like, oh.
Well, touche. Cue hail of arrows. And it's, and yeah, it makes it so that the violence is, it's not just this obligatory long battle sequence. It makes it so that the violence means something. And we finally see the violence and these hail of arrows, and it's so many arrows.
And they're coming pretty close to him for a while.
And they're, like, actually shooting arrows at Toshiro Mifune, and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. How are you doing this? And he's going for long, and he's taking them.
And he's running and screaming.
And you're wondering how long this is going to go. And then one of the most bonkers shots, the shot of him getting shot in the neck.
Mm.
How did they do that? Because it's just, we're just looking at him, and one frame, there's not an arrow in the, through his neck. And the next frame, there is an arrow through the neck, and it doesn't look like there was a cut.
Yeah, it...
How did you do that? And the sound design, just the thunk.
And you see, like the little raised portion of flesh around the hole.
Yeah.
So it's like, there's clearly makeup and that has been applied, but we don't see the cut, so it just looks like, oh, that just tore through his neck.
Yeah, and it's so visceral, it's so good, and the violence finally is on screen, and it's brutal. And then we end not with Banquo's son on the throne, but just in the middle of the fog with the people moving the trees, and we finally see that there were people, that Macduff was moving the trees. And then that's the end. The end, we began the movie in medias res in the middle of a battle, and we end the movie in medias res in the middle of a battle. Nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
Only more people are dead. And so Lady Macbeth is less of a character, but she is just this, the push for violence. And it just rips right through this movie, and it kills a bunch of people. And I think it makes Macbeth a lot stronger thematically. I think Throne of Blood is a lot stronger thematically than Macbeth is usually, because it's about how this lust for violence just rips through people and tears them to shreds and just ruins everything. And so, yeah, and we begin and end on this was where the castle was. So, and the this chorus of people singing about how violence sucks and this is all bad.
Yeah, and we, in the essay we read, it mentions that this is not just the historical feudal Japan that is kind of, I don't know, part of this film, but it's also the 20th century violence of total war that is, you know, influencing this degree of, the sentiment.
Yeah. This degree of slaughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, Throne of Blood is one of the best movies ever.
Yeah.
absolutely stunning to look at again. Mm. Like the production design of the castle, I love the design in the big banquet hall. And the best scene of the movie is Mifune awaiting Banquo's arrival / death. It's just played so beautifully. The camera sweeps beautifully. It's just a masterful production. Okay. And then
Boy and the Heron.
Let's quickly talk about the biopics, I think.
Okay.
Are you all right?
Oh yeah.
Okay. Let's quickly talk, before we talk about The Boy and the Heron, because yes, we saw Miyazaki's new film, Boy and the Heron. I want to talk about the biopics. Okay. I'm not a sneezer. That was just a temporary lapse in judgment. Mm. We watched I'm Not There, and we watched Tesla. Two unconventional biopics of Bob Dylan and Nikola Tesla, respectively. What do you think of I'm Not There?
I heard about this movie a while ago as like, oh, it's the movie where Cate Blanchett plays Bob Dylan. I was like, hey, that sounds cool. And yeah, it's a movie where Bob Dylan is played by six different actors, but they're none of them called Bob Dylan. They're each like their own character. Like one's like Jack Rollins and one's Jude Quinn, and they're each their own character having their own story, but all of them kind of capture part of Dylan's life and part of who he was.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not who was, but you know, who he's been.
Mm-hmm.
And they just kind of flow together and generally just show like the progression of his life.
Yeah, it's very, very strange film. I felt like this movie just went completely over my head for a lot of it. Like the first time I saw it, I didn't know who Dylan was really. And so this movie was just like, what? And this time around, I know who Dylan is. I know his music. And like, I get some of the references that are being made. Like I get the reference to A Hard Day's Night now, which is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
I get the reference to Don't Look Back, with Cat, who is essentially who Cate Blanchett is playing, is that version of Bob Dylan that we see in Don't Look Now or Don't Look Back. And yeah, no, I think this movie is fantastic. It's just, it's very strange, and I feel like it's making a lot of like references and artistic references that I'm just not getting. So like kind of how you felt about Labyrinth of Cinema, I felt about I'm Not There.
Yeah, and I that's something that I know about this movie, but I don't feel as much, and like, you know, because I'm able to say like, oh, that's Joan Baez. That's supposed to be Joan Baez.
Yeah, I think. Julianne Moore is playing a essentially Joan Baez.
Yeah, and I can get some elements of like timeline, but there's so much more that I just don't register.
The film is, yeah, it is the. The I contain multitudes, the movie.
Mm-hmm.
How no one person is just one person. They are a whole lot of things, and you can tell their story a whole lot of different ways. And I think that's beautiful because it's so not boring. Because so many biopics are just the same beats over and over again, and this one doesn't settle for that. Like, there's one section of the movie that stars Christian Bale. That is like your typical like musician documentary that's like talking heads and stuff like that. But it's also still subverting that a little. And then it's putting it up against all these other storylines to show you how much more that biopics can be. So yeah, it's very dense, and I quite love it, even though I don't totally get it.
Yeah. And I like it as a statement of like you said, against, like, more conventional biopics, because, like, whereas I feel a lot of biopics kind of take the historical figure and then force their life into the typical beats of a movie.
This film refuses to do that.
Yeah, it doesn't force it into a pre-existing shape. It defies that completely.
Yeah.
All
right. And then Tesla, which is a bit more conventional, but still very goofy and playful. Michael Almereyda's film with Ethan Hawke. Just very silly picture, very silly time. Does not care about the fourth wall. And yeah.
I loved at the end, I heard the first few notes and I was like, is it? Oh, I know this song. Oh, he's on stage.
There is no image more obvious or blunt. You know, this movie is not subtle. It's just going to have Nikola Tesla singing "Everybody Wants to Rule the World."
Yeah, showing how he is a sad boy by having him sing the music of the Ultimate Sad Boys.
Yeah, it's obvious, but also no one did it.
Yeah.
And so now we have this amazing scene of Ethan Hawke singing Everybody Wants to Rule the World as Nikola Tesla. Kyle MacLachlan is lovely as Edison. What I love about this film is that in, like Selma, Ava DuVernay's Selma, which is one of my favorite films and one of the better biopics, that film was ostensibly about Martin Luther King Jr., but it was really about the larger movement and all of the different players and all everything that all of them contributed together. And yes, Martin Luther King Jr. was a spearhead, but he wasn't the only thing happening. He was just a part of a movement. And I like what Tesla does that also, and shows that he was a part of a movement. And this film is told about Tesla, but it is told by Anne Morgan, who was a long time maybe a thing with Nikola Tesla. And she is telling us the story and bringing up Google results on her MacBook and, you know, lots of little cute things. But she is telling the story about all of these men and their relationships with the women, which are integral to her as whatever they made. And so I really like that ensemble view of the biopic, that it is about not just a tortured genius, but it's about this community, and it's about the women in these men's lives that are as worthy of note as the men are. And so, yeah, Kyle MacLachlan and Ethan Hawke just smooshing ice cream in each other's faces. It's good times.
Yeah, I love that.
Anything else on Tesla?
I like, you know, the conflict between idealism and capitalism, and that
yes,
Tesla wants to do it because it would benefit people, and yeah. Like
I just want to give it away.
Everyone should have this technology, and but he can't.
He
can't play by the rules of a capitalist system. You know, where everyone is wondering what they will get out of it and why they would do this for him. And, and he can't make that work.
It's always sad.
Yeah.
All right. Boy and the Heron. New Hayao Miyazaki film. First one in 10 years. Cause for celebration.
Oh, yes.
You talk about it.
Yeah. So it about a boy and a heron. But the start of the movie, we see the boy's mother die horribly in a fire. And he is, you know, fairly soon after moved out to the country to live with his aunt, who is his going to be his father's new wife.
He's marrying his dead wife's sister, younger sister.
Yeah.
And they're already going to have a kid.
Yeah, and the kid's not that kid, but you know, the main kid.
Our protagonist
is not really too happy about that. Like, he's not really ready to let go of his mom. Maybe he doesn't like that his dad has moved on so fast, and he's having a hard time adjusting to this new person in his life. And while he's there out in this country house with his new stepmom and a bunch of grannies who are delightful. Nice old grannies.
We have more entries in the Hayao Miyazaki's old wrinkly ladies, the sweet old ladies canon.
They are very short and very wrinkly.
They are very small. They are very wrinkly. They are very sweet, and they are very subservient. Mm. All of them, with the exception of the matriarch in Castle in the Sky, who's awesome.
And maybe Kiriko in this one. Is not too submissive.
No, but you're fair.
But all the others.
Yeah, all the others certainly are. Yeah. They are there to protect
the nuclear family. Yeah. That is their function.
They care about the kids and the... Yeah, so, yeah.
In these movies.
And they're explicitly, I think, mentioned as a protective
force
in this movie.
Yeah. So, and then there's this heron shows up and it brings them to a magical world. And magic and wonder ensue.
Yeah.
Do you like this movie?
Yes. I think I want to see it again because I went to this movie intentionally not knowing anything and like trying to avoid all promotional material, just being like, I know I'm going to see it. Let's see it. Yeah. And I want to go into it knowing where it ends.
You like Howl's Moving Castle?
Yes. I'm very fond of Howl's Moving Castle.
I do not like Howl's Moving Castle. And my reason for not liking Howl's Moving Castle is because I think it bites off way more than it can chew. And it ends up having a bunch of kind of like half baked ideas. Mm-hmm. Instead of one cohesive through line. And I kind of feel like that's the case here. There is a lot going on in The Boy and the Heron. And there's so much stuff to do with world building that feels like it kind of comes out of nowhere and doesn't add a lot. And is this really... Why am I care about... Like, the peacocks are funny. They're funny. The parakeets are funny. They're really fun. Budgies. They're cute. The budgies, they get a lot of laughs out of you. I'm really not sure what they contribute to the movie in terms of its thematic goal. And so it feels like there's a lot to like in this movie, and then there's a lot else that is trying to distract you.
And I felt that especially with like the warawara, the cute little beings that will eventually become people.
Yeah, there's just yeah,
it feels like there's a lot of world building that I'm like, oh, and this, so this is what this fantasy world means, you know, so this is the point of this other world we're entering.
But then not really.
But then it kind of leaves that, it doesn't explain it, and doesn't quite tie it all together for me, and so I'm kind of...
Yeah, this film... I don't know. I'm mixed on this movie. I do not think this is one of his best, at least off the bat. Maybe my view will change as time goes on. But yeah, I found this film kind of messy. And it's very pretty. It looks gorgeous, of course.
Mm.
You know, a month spent on every minute of animation, it shows. It's fantastic. But at the end, I kind of am just sitting there feeling, what was I supposed to get out of this? And your mom really likes this movie and has brought up a lot of good points about, like, how it's about the letting go of the patriarchy. And I've kind of come around to, like, the pacing of the film because it feels like we're supposed to get all these answers and then it just kind of, you just don't get them. And it just moves on, and it resolves really quickly after that. And I feel like that maybe there's some thematic stuff there about, like, how this is about grieving the death of his mother, how it's, like, I felt like I was supposed to get more out of this relationship with my mom, and now this time I was wanting more time out with my mom, and now it's just over, and what am I doing now? And it's kind of the same with this magical world, maybe, but also maybe it's just paced poorly and resolves too quickly. I don't know. So it just... I found it frustrating, especially in the back half, just like, what am I supposed to be getting out of this?
Yeah.
What is this supposed to mean?
And I feel like there's some stuff that I can explain later, like by, like thinking about it later and like, especially with that, you know, idea of like letting go of the patriarch. And I was also thinking about like, you know, this fantasy world is, kind of maybe mirroring the real world and the real war by having this weird conflict with the budgies and like some weird like, or I don't know, maybe not, it's not too much of a conflict, I guess, but like there's weird political stuff going on in this fantasy world and there's weird political stuff going on in the extra world. And so there might be some relationship there and that, you know, we need to, I don't know, like, like there's a letting go of both. But I feel like I didn't feel that in my initial viewing of the film,
yeah,
and only could explain that after I'd already seen it.
And there's also a lot of stuff going on about like commentary on war, like, and violence, like in the real world, because it is set during World War II, and the dad is an arms manufacturer. He's making Zero planes, but it doesn't get into that. And like, what does this have to do anything? And then there's a lot of like imagery that's about like the contrasting between the old world and then the modern world. But it's that factor. I don't know what this movie's getting at. And so there, it's very pretty and the music is good. And the score is great in fits and starts. And there's a couple scenes that really stick with me. The scene where the heron first confronts the boy, like properly confronts the boy at the stream with the fish and the frogs, is very unsettling. And then there's a scene later in the film under the stars that is just kind of wondrous. And the music really swells there, sings there. But I think this film is biting off a lot, and I'm not sure that it really coheres at the end.
And because a lot of it's kind of mysterious. Like, it starts out all mysterious, being like, what's up with this heron? And then we get in the fantasy world and we're like, where are we? What is this place? And it in doing that, it sets up the expectation that
we're going to get answers.
We're going to get answers, and we're following along in this story to find out what's going on, and that's you know something we're chasing after in watching this movie. And I didn't quite feel that I got there, and so like
we get an explanation, or do we? But it doesn't matter, and it doesn't make sense.
It doesn't quite satisfy the expectations. At least for me, it didn't quite satisfy the expectations that it set up for me. You know, like, yeah, and there's some conflicting world-building stuff, at least to my mind, that didn't really get resolved where I expected it to. And so it didn't really give me what what it seemed like it wanted me to, Yeah, the setup didn't really,
pay off.
Yeah, and it might on another viewing, but it didn't quite in the moment.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
I
which is a bummer to come out of a new Hayao Miyazaki film feeling that way, but.
Yeah, I mean, I quite enjoyed it. It was definitely good watch. It was a very pretty movie. Had a lot of moments I really liked. I really liked that the pelican moment.
Pelican moment. I liked there's just a little moment where just this woman is on a ship in the wind and she has to turn the ship. And it's just gorgeous animation of her like working with the ship, you know, and the sail and all that. And it's that's like just really sings. And so there are little bits in this movie, but as a work, I'm not really sure that it comes together. Yeah. So, and then we saw another new film from a very old man who's been making movies for a very long time and is considered one of, if not the best, in his realm of expertise, and we saw the new Frederick Wiseman film, which is called, what?
Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gros.
And this was your first Frederick Wiseman movie, who is one of my favorite directors, and our very first podcast that we did on The Screen's Margins, this podcast network feed, was the first episode of our weekly Wiseman, in which we talk, me and Harold Urtiaga talked about all of Wiseman's films. We got through all of his films that were released in the 21st century, starting with City Hall and working our way back to Domestic Violence. And it was, I loved that podcast very, very much. And now he's got a new movie. I was so excited. And it was my Christmas present that you took me all the way up to Seattle to see it. At the SIFF Egyptian, one of my favorite theaters. And we saw it. And it was 4 hours long. Exactly. And we sat through the entire thing. And no breaks. And it was... And yeah. And then it ended. We were like... Oh!
Yeah.
And we wanted more.
Which I was so surprised by. Like, I've never seen... Like, I'd never seen a Wiseman film.
Yeah.
And so I wasn't quite sure how, like...
You what do you know about Wiseman going into it?
That it's... It pretty much just watching people do stuff.
Yeah.
Do their thing.
There's no text. There's no music. There's no interviews. There's nothing. It is just a camera pointed at people... At things at work, mm-hmm. institutions at work, and for anywhere between 3 and 6 hours.
Yeah, and I was wondering, you know, quite how I'd, you know, feel about that long of a film, and like I never, you know, sat through that long of a film without an intermission or anything. Yeah,
let alone in the theater.
Yeah, and I got to the end, and I was like, oh, that's it. I thought there were I was ready for like another hour.
Yeah. So we are following, assigned 3 Michelin stars by the Michelin guide, the Guide Michelin, this restaurant outside of Rouen, which is northeast of Lyon. Ooh. So the countryside, I was like, I've seen countryside like that before. And we did on our train trip from Paris to Lyon. We might have stopped at Rouen. Not that we got off, but we probably passed through Rouen.
Yeah.
Anyway, and their restaurant originally was in the station at Rouen. Mm. And then became across the station. And now it's where this film is mostly set, is out in the countryside. And... We follow this dude Michel and his sons Caesar and Leo, and they are the best chefs.
Yeah.
And we follow the discussion of almond sauce and passion fruit, and it's them at work in the kitchen, and it's their team at work in the kitchen, and it's the preparation of the food and talking with the customers, the clients. And we see the food being made and being purchased, and we talk with the suppliers of the food, and we go to the cheese factory. The cheese aging factory. Moldy cheese.
I really liked the cheese factory sequence. Did not I don't want to connect that viewing experience to my eating of cheese, I think.
You just see cheeses caked in mold.
Yeah.
Which, that is what cheese is, honey. It's moldy. It's mold.
Yeah. I try not to think about it.
This film is so delightful. I loved it. I loved it.
So good.
Watching them at work, my favorite bit. Outside of the cheese bit, which is very fun, it feels like this very interesting tangent, because I think it's like the only extended amount of time that we spend away from any of our 3 main characters. Sometimes we have Wiseman will focus on individuals, and sometimes he won't. Oftentimes it's just the ensemble of all the people at work at the New York Public Library or in the town of Monrovia, Indiana, et cetera, et cetera. This time he's focused on Michelle and Caesar and Leo and the people who work for them. This is the most time that we spend away from any recognizable faces. And it's just this guy talking about cheese for like 15 minutes. And he's so hyped to tell you all about it. And it's like this very weird it's not weird. It feels like, yeah, it feels like when we watched, was it, Return of the Thin Man, when like Powell and Myrna Loy are at this like dance club and they're like, oh, look over there, and then we just watch some dancers for a while. Mm-hmm. It's like that. It's like, let's watch this guy talk about cheese for a while.
And it's so good, like the subtitles are going so fast, and I'm just like, oh wow.
So that I love that bit in the movie. this film is at its best when it's just watching at towards the end of the film. It's late at night, and we're just watching Michelle working with some kidneys, and it just in a wide shot. And he's just doing his thing. He's completely in the zone. He's throwing tongs like these tongs are impossible. throws them to a guy.
Guy catches.
It's so fun to see people be good at their jobs.
And it's fun when that job is food.
Yeah.
they know what they're talking about, and so it's fun to listen to them, and they know what they're doing, and it's fun to watch. I love the close-ups of, like, them cooking, where it's just like, and let's watch, like, somewhat, like, chocolate batter be scraped around for a bit.
Oh, yes. And, my jaw's on the floor.
And let's watch them carefully put
a wine glass.
Yes, and just carefully put all of the food together, and it's just watching.
Yeah,
it's very
using
close
little
up.
Tweezers and there's a lot of close ups in this movie, which is not usual for a Wiseman film. There's a lot of close ups, so it seems like there's just like either a lot more cameras at play, or a lot more camera angles at play than usual. So that is something that really stood out to me. It is not John Davey, who has been a Wiseman cinematographer for all the films that I've seen up until now. It's a different guy. So I hope that John Davey is okay. I wonder if he just wasn't able to do this film or something. But a slightly different visual style in this movie. If I have a gripe with this film, it is the absence of the dishwashing. Mm. Because it seems like we see pretty much everything else to do with this restaurant. We see
beds getting made. We see
beds.
Yeah, there's like one quick shot of like, oh, and we'll push this bed up against the wall and get the iron.
No, that was a tablecloth.
That was a bed.
That was.
You don't see the iron. I mean, you see the iron for the tablecloth. You don't see they're like
okay
or something like
because it is also a hotel.
So you see, like, a little bit of that, like, okay. Like preparing, like, a bath
I don't remember that.
Preparing, like, they're, like, cleaning the bathtub, preparing, like, the bathroom for clients.
I do not remember that.
Yeah, there's a whole shot. It's, like, really white and light in there, and they're cleaning, looks like they're cleaning guest rooms kind of thing.
Are you sure that's not the tablecloth bit?
That is not a tablecloth. I know what a table looks like.
Okay, I have no memory of that. I don't have my notes because all the other Wiseman films I've seen of his documentaries, I would take notes on all of them, and I would have lists of every single scene and interstitial, because his films go scene, interstitial, maybe montage, interstitial. I'm afraid I can't refer back to my notes.
Yeah. It is a very brief moment, but you do see it.
Anyway, what we don't see is the dishwasher.
Yeah.
There are a lot of pots and pans and dishes being used in this movie, and we never see them get cleaned. And as someone who is deeply traumatized by the experience of dishwashing at a busy restaurant on Labor Day, by myself for 9 hours, I was like, where's the dishwasher? So if I have a single gripe. Where's my dishwasher?
But it does add to the fantasy of we get to watch this food being made and we have no consequences.
Yeah. I would like to take you to one of these places. You said that you had no interest in going to one of these restaurants, this kind of restaurant.
Yeah, I feel like if it was like financially feasible, it would be cool to like have the experience, like if that's what people want.
But do you understand now why there are restaurants that cost this much?
Oh yeah.
because neither of us are that familiar with like the ultra expensive dining experiences.
I'm happy with kebab. Kebab is pretty great. They know,
but just like it seems ridiculous that food would cost that much.
Yeah.
I understand now.
Yeah,
the amount of labor.
And I think
and expertise that goes into it.
And I think one, you know, perception that I had going into it was that the portions are so small, you're not even getting a meal out of it. Mm-hmm. But it's because there are 9 of them. And they're like a lot of them are like high protein.
So, like, you are getting a meal out of 9 courses.
Yes.
It just looks small one by one.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's and the sheer amount of ingredients that go into every single dish, like they labor. There's so much work that goes into this, and I have a much deeper appreciation for this kind of dining experience, and I would like to take you someday. It is now my goal to take us someday to a restaurant, if not this one, then one like it. I bet there's going to be a lot of people who aren't usually into this kind of thing who are now going to start attending the Trogwa's restaurants because of this film.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Good for them. Yeah, and I love hearing them talk shop about, like, the flavors and crafting of the dish.
Yeah.
And, like, and it feels like they're not just throwing together the old recipe. It feels like they're always creating it anew.
Yes.
And I really respect that.
Yeah. The discussion of wine is a little bit more, like, really? What? It's like talking about all the hints and the hominid and the of these wines, and I'm just like, this is what's going on. Maybe that's just me not being a person who drinks wine. Maybe that's me just turning my nose up at snooty people. But, like, also, people would do that to me about movies. So maybe, I don't know. I have a hard time believing that there's that the way that the people talk about wine in this movie seems a little out there for me.
And I wasn't as like this didn't bother me as much as like some people. Like I don't know. Like so sometimes I like it
angers
where it's just like ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean like the concept of like a $10,000 bottle of wine
seems ridiculous
because you're gonna drink it. It's there for you to drink, like
yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, if that's what you're into, then and you like want to spend a bunch of money and know a lot about it, then
yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, and I like that people like what they're doing and like their craft and like if they're gonna make wine, they're gonna be like, I want to make you know.
We see how much work goes into. We do visit a vineyard and they talk about how much goes into that stuff. And towards the end, there's this very long conversation with a man who just retired from running a vineyard, passed it on to his sons. Anyway, this movie, it just ends. You must be approaching the end by this point, and then it just ends. And Wiseman films are such that you never cut to black. You keep cutting between scenes and interstitials, and you just keep going, and then eventually the film fades to black and it's over. And when I saw it start to fade to black, I was like, no.
Yeah.
But it's the perfect moment.
Yeah, and I think like, because like a little before that, there was like a shot of an empty table, and I was like, oh, are we getting there? And then it keeps going. I'm like, oh, okay, no. And it has. I like what it ends on because there's this long conversation about. Like the family history.
Yeah, and the context comes all at the end, which is interesting, instead of at the beginning. You're just kind of thrown into it, and you learn as you go, and then at the end does he tell the story to a couple at the restaurant. Mm. And ends with, everything is beautiful. Mm. Couple little shots, fade to black. You're like, oh!
Yeah, and I really like seeing these people talk to the customers, because they're... And I assume if you have, like, so few who can be your customer.
And, like, they know them.
Yeah.
They talk about, oh, yes, these people are coming back. They're regulars. We know all about them. We know their dietary stuff and stuff and stuff. And
they come in and say hi to the chefs. Like, or
they have their own menus kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, that's really cool. Like, I like... how much they can talk to the customers about the food and how much they can talk to the customers in general.
Yeah.
It seems like a nice energy.
Yeah. I think this is one of Wiseman's better efforts. It's just very, I'm bit, the Wiseman bug has bit me yet again. I want to watch Wiseman again. There's a reason that this guy's one of my favorites. So, all right.
A very pleasant watch.
Yeah. I'm sorry we had to record all of this over again.
It's okay. When we started recording, the car, I was like, is that gonna be a problem? And then I was like, And I'm kind of like, oh, if only I'd.
No, I figured that it would have come out. Like, I could have. No, it was just garbage audio. Yeah. Anyway. All right. We're done now. Right? Is there anything?
And we have watched a couple movies since.
Next week.
Okay.
Next week. Yeah.